Future Proof Extra from News Talk.
Now, the COVID-19 crisis has dominated pretty much every aspect of our lives, and so much so that it's easy to forget the other crisis that's been raging for the last number of decades, the climate crisis. But our reaction to COVID-19 might just give us a glimpse into the possibilities of a greener, cleaner future, one that shows us that we can make change for the greater good and act with emergency and urgency when we need to. But are we running out of chances to act? Well, Mark Lyons is an environmental writer, visiting fellow with the Cornell Alliance for Science at Cornell University, and author of Our Final Warning, 6 Degrees of Climate Emergency. He joins me now. Welcome back to the program, Mark. This is a sort of a follow-on from your book, 6 Degrees, which was, 13 years ago?
2007, too far to count.
Yeah, and at that time, like many science journalists, like many climate writers, you know, the projections of what we were doing to the planet were already quite clear. But has there been a big shift in the outlook across those 13 years? Because that was when, by 2007, we knew we were in serious trouble.
Yeah, and, you know, most writers don't write the same book twice, but I was sort of persuaded into doing this because I wanted to answer exactly that question. And people kept asking me, you know, who'd read the original book in 2007? You know, here we are 10, nearly 15 years on. Is it worse than things looked then? Or are you more optimistic? You know, and the only way I could really answer that question properly was to go back and basically repeat the same exercise and look at hundreds upon hundreds of scientific papers, put them all together into a picture of our likely future and try and get a readout really of what was different about the science. So I'm more pessimistic, to give you the quick answer here, in many ways, given how rapidly the climate is changing. So we're on a rapidly heating trajectory, which wasn't clear in 2007 that would be the case. You know, we've already lost most of the world's coral reefs. We're seeing very rapid changes in Greenland and the polar ice sheets. You know, every single year we seem to set a new heat record somewhere. It was in the UK, in fact, it was all-time hottest in 2019. So the planet is sending us emergency signals. And for me, the fact that we're now seeing in real time, as it were, in our actual lives, things that were previously just predictions when I wrote the first edition of this book, is probably the scariest thing of all.
Mm. And of course, they were, you know, sort of framed as doomsday predictions in the early 2000s. And yet many of these sort of plagues, pestilence, floods and the rest have come to pass. So I know it's nowhere near this simplistic, but if we were to try and draw a line from 2007, when you wrote the first book, to 2020, and if we imagine that line is temperature, and in 2007 we were imagining it to go to where it is in 2013, has that diagonal line, has it become more steep, or have we managed to flatten the curve a bit, or are we just further on in time on what we thought was going to happen?
In terms of temperature rise, the increase is pretty much what the models predicted for the emissions that we're currently releasing. So it's more or less on the worst case scenario, to be brutally frank. It's not like every single year is hotter than the previous year, but in terms of the decadal average, we're tracking at a very high rate indeed. And you can see that with the breaking of temperature records, what happened in Australia with the wildfire heat crisis recently. And in fact, 2020 is forecast to probably be the hottest year ever again. So there's no, you know, I suppose it just adds to the consensus that we have amongst scientists that this is a problem which is getting more urgent all the time. So there's no, I mean, I guess back in 2007, there was still debate even in some quarters about the reality of climate change. There isn't anymore. That debate's long, long finished.
But we've done all this stuff since 2007. I mean, so many companies have changed their practices. We've you know, reduced our carbon emissions. We've switched to electric cars and blah, blah, blah. Surely that should have had some sort of effect on the curve as predicted.
Right. So we're now looking at the emissions curve, of course, and the two things don't directly correspond.
Oh, do they not?
No, I mean, temperature doesn't go up in lockstep with emissions because there's all sorts of other stuff going on in terms of, you know, shifts in weather patterns and so on. And it takes takes many years for the temperature of the planet to catch up with the emissions that are already accumulating in the atmosphere. But I mean, what's really concerning, I suppose, is that all of the progress that we've made, and a lot of it's very encouraging, you know, we are transitioning away from coal in power generation. We are seeing, you know, small increases in the numbers of electric cars that people are buying. There's net zero targets and such like, but none of that's really changed the increasing accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. And that's what's driving heating. And if you look at that graph, and there's a very famous one called the Keeling curve, because it was first started by a scientist called Charles Keeling back in the 50s, from the top of Mauna Kea, which is this huge volcano in Hawaii, and they sample the atmosphere there, and the curve just goes upwards every single year, and that upward curve is accelerating. So we haven't done anything yet which is sufficient to really change to flatten that curve, which is probably the most important one of all.
So are you saying, when you say that they're not in lockstep, obviously I know there's lots of other factors, but I thought they were quite highly correlated because of greenhouse gases and that system. Is what are the other factors at play that might keep our temperature down, even though we're throwing more carbon dioxide into the atmosphere?
Oh, probably the key one is the El Nino shift in the Pacific Ocean. So basically, most of the heat that is produced because of increasing greenhouse gases goes into the oceans. It doesn't actually affect the atmosphere so much, because you can store a lot more heat in water than you can in air. And so when you get the warm El Nino, a lot of heat is released from the tropical Pacific. When it's cold, which is in the flip side, which is called La Nina, a lot more heat is then absorbed in the Pacific, and that affects global temperatures. So the way that heat circulates within the Earth system changes quite a lot year on year, and so that affects what our reading is for the global average air temperature.
Okay.
But there's a lot of stuff going on. I mean, there's a change in the output of the sun, and so there's so many different factors all the time that it isn't as if every single increment in our emissions increase is going to directly translate into a temperature increase the same year.
But over time, on average, they are loosely correlated?
Well, what's most correlated actually is what's called the cumulative emissions. If you add up the total stock of carbon that we have emitted over the last, 100 years really, and going forward, that is very closely correlated to the ultimate temperature outcome. We know that for two degrees, we can only afford to emit a couple of 100 billion more tons of carbon. And
the reason I'm sort of going on about this point is because I'm sure people are listening, thinking, then why are we going to such efforts to reduce carbon emissions?
Because we only have a certain budget, and once you've exhausted the budget, then you're going to go over the temperature that you're trying to stop at. So the Paris Agreement of 2015 agreed to limit global temperature rises to 1.5 degrees. We're already at 1 degree. And to limit that temperature rise, we'd have to stop emitting carbon within about 10 years. So, all right, that's not going to happen. In that case, maybe we need to go for the secondary target, which is 2 degrees. But even that means we've got to make rapid year-on-year cuts we'd have to peak emissions within 10 years from now and be at net zero by mid-century. And the key number here is the actual carbon budget, so the total amount of carbon that humanity emits over
the. So when we were talking about climate change, you know, in 2000, people projected to 2050, it seemed quite far away, but it is sneaking very much closer. When you say we are at 1 degree, how far back do we have to go to say that difference between now and back then is 1 degree?
So that's the difference between pre-industrial temperatures. So about, you know, the end of the 19th century and now. And right, when I wrote the first edition in 2007, we were still under that 1 degree level. So that was still, you know, that was a few, that was still projecting into the future. But this is now, that future is now what we're currently living in. We crossed the 1 degree threshold in, if I remember rightly, about 2015. So we've only got a few tenths of a degree to go before we'll be hitting the 1.5, which is the Paris Agreement target.
Right. So when we hear governments talking about, you know, net carbon emissions being zero by 2050, I think the UK has talked about this. I think other countries have talked about this. How realistic is that?
Well, it depends on how optimistic you are about how rapidly we can make this transition.
Bitterly pessimistic.
Well, if that's your starting point, I mean, it's understandable, but in some ways, having experienced, as we all have, this pandemic, it shows actually how rapidly we can change when things are really seriously urgent. You know, we need to save lives in 2 weeks' time. So we lock down the country.
Yeah.
You know, if we need to save lives in 2 decades' time, we need to stop emitting carbon. It's harder to think over that timescale, but it's not impossible. You know, we think about our pensions, we think about mortgages, we think about our kids. So there are ways, I think, in which people can engage in a future which isn't actually that far off and make changes to their lifestyles now. But, you know, what you do personally isn't really the be-all and the end-all. We've got to have a shift which is across the whole of society. Just as with the lockdown, there's no point in just, you know, telling old people to stay at home or shutting the schools and letting everyone else get on with business as usual. It has to be a transition which affects everyone. And for the UK, I mean, they're currently talking about when they've got to stop getting, you know, they've got to stop selling fossil fuel cars. Diesel, petrol vehicles will have to be, first they'll have to stop selling them, then they'll have to be off the roads. And everything will have to be zero emissions from about 2035, 2040 onwards. That's a huge transition, but people are going to have to get used to it.
I think the motor industry, from conversations I've had, seem to be committed to that idea. I think most will see there's not a huge market, both from a demand, but also from a legislation point of view. There's not going to be much of a market for petrol or diesel cars in 10 years. And speaking to some manufacturers, they're saying, look, we are lots of stuff in production that was already there, but once that's gone, we won't be designing any new cars that aren't fully electric. That's what they say, but then, you know, you've got a history of scandals in the past decade alone that makes you question the source. But if we look at the big changes that we're going to need to make beyond, you know, thinking about switching your light off at home, is there anything that stands out to you that is achievable, that will make a significant dent in what we're talking about?
Yes, decarbonizing the electricity supply is probably the quickest and easiest thing to do. And actually in the UK, I can't speak for the Republic, because I don't know that as intimately, but for the UK, we've now been free from coal, and the overall generation of coal into our electricity is down at like 3% or something, you know. And I remember when I first did the 6 degrees, it was, you know, what, 10, 15 years ago, that was 40%. I mean, yeah. It looked like coal was there forever. And it's, you know, we've almost got down to zero coal. Yes, there's still gas in the mix, but we've got huge increases in renewables, offshore wind in particular, with some contribution from solar. And we've still got nuclear, which is an essential part of the low carbon mix as well. So, you know, we don't want to be shutting those down. And I think we do want to look at a new generation of nuclear as well to complement the renewables. So, you know, we've got intermittency and there's other problems with renewable generation, which we haven't completely solved yet. But the technology is definitely there. So we can have zero carbon electricity, and we can do that in a relatively short space of time, probably 20, 25 years.
Why is the world still dragging their feet when it comes to nuclear? Why would we continue not to open up? I mean, obviously there's the emotional thing of Chernobyl, Fukushima, and so on, but surely the whole world should have gone nuclear or decided to go nuclear 10 years ago.
Well, nuclear has been subject to a 50-year misinformation campaign by the anti-nuclear lobby, which is which has successfully demonized it in the minds of most people, including young people. In my experience, it's still happening. People still believe that nuclear is uniquely dangerous in some way, and actually, it's not. It's got a, despite the disasters which are very well publicized and very well known, like Chernobyl and Fukushima, the death rate is hundreds of thousands of what you have from fossil fuels. And it's comparable with renewables, with solar and wind, you know. So it's very difficult, though, to change the psychology of these things. And that then feeds through to the economics, because you have to make them triply, quadruply safe. And that makes them very expensive to build. So we're, you know, looking at, I'm most excited about the new generation of what they call SMRs, which are small modular reactors, which could be basically walk away safe. They could never do a Chernobyl, and hopefully would be a lot cheaper and could be used much more widely across the world. Because, you know, nuclear is basically, you know, for the timescales that we're talking about, inexhaustible supply of low carbon, zero carbon fuel. And we'd be pretty stupid to turn our nose up at that in the context of the climate crisis.
What, I mean, when I do interviews about environment, there's sort of a catch-22, and you probably find this yourself, that talking about this and not giving people hope isn't great for getting them to do the few things that they can do. And at the same time, realistically looking at the mountain in front of us and thinking that we can do anything to shift it, given the dragging of feet of some countries and the complete reversal of policy by others, notably America, it's sort of a strange one. You sort of want to find little pockets of hope to give people motivation to keep going and caring about this stuff. And at the same time, realistically, I don't see how any climate journalist has anything but doom in front of them.
Yeah, but there's doom and there's doom and there's apocalypse and there's not too bad and there's really catastrophic, and there's a whole spectrum between those two outcomes. It's not like it's black or white. We win or we lose, you know. It's apocalypse or it's salvation, you know. There's this sort of Manichaean biblical thinking, I think, is part of the problem. So yeah, we won't make 1.5 degrees, we won't save the world's coral reefs predominantly, we are going to see rapid sea level rise and increased temperature, but it's still plenty of time. I mean, I say plenty, but there's still time to avoid outcomes where we see large-scale starvation and civilizational collapse, which would kick in probably at 3-4 degrees and upwards. Now, we're still on the trajectory to get to those high levels of warming, but we can bend the curve, absolutely, and that's already started to happen in a lot of countries. Yeah, you've got crazy denialists like Donald Trump, and there's been, you know, I think it's very worrying to see this right-wing populist resurgence, a lot of which is about climate denial. But hopefully those times will pass and you'll see a reversion to more sensible, science-based, reality-based politics around the world. It's not too late, and it never will be too late. You know, even if we're heading to 4 degrees, well, it's still better than 5. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. So I don't think we ever give up.
Yeah, this is you know, I talk to my children all the time about having a golden mindset, which is something I picked up from a book, which was sort of extolling the virtues of getting your kid to look on the bright side of whatever was in front of them. You're right. Of course, there's always inaction, apathy, and doing nothing is no good. I guess what people are fighting for is, to me, you know, has often been sold as, you know, would you like to die by being stoned to death or being set on fire? But you're right, that's probably the wrong, and very biblical, the wrong way of thinking about this, that action is urgent and important. When we look at particular industries, is there one that is going in completely the wrong direction, that isn't getting enough media attention, or that we really need to talk about? Is there an industry that stands out, whether it's food production or whether it's oil or how we treat water or whatever it is? Is there something that seems to be doing the opposite of what we need to do?
I think you've got to split this down into a set of manageable tasks, right? And, you know, there's no point in us in Western Europe worrying too much about what's happening in China or India even, or even the United States. You know, you're talking to me from the Republic of Ireland, and you've got your problems, which you can solve quite easily there. You can stop burning peat in power stations, which is an environmental crime second to none. You can really upscale the deployment of offshore renewables, wind, obviously, things like that, which, you know, you've got to tackle the farming sector, agriculture, big emissions from livestock. There's a lot of ways you can change the incentive, let's put it diplomatically, for farmers, given that farming is almost entirely supported by subsidies. So the general public who pay the taxes which result in those subsidies have a perfect right to have some input into how farming changes and shifts towards being more ultimately zero carbon. You can start sequestering carbon by allowing trees to regrow in places where, you know, you're not having it constantly grazed by livestock. You know, I'm talking to you from the Welsh borders. We've got sheep on all the mountains here. It's picturesque to many people, and it's a, you know, a highly valued cultural way of life, but at the same time, it strips the hills of their biodiversity and stops trees coming back, and it's a pretty inefficient way to produce meat. So I think we've got to see some kind of, you know, way through this, which means that people aren't just doing the same as they've always been doing. And that goes for all sectors of the economy. I mean, the climate challenge affects all of us, and we've all got to play a part.
What is the difference, the big difference between your outlook from 2007 to now? When you finished the book, was there a big difference in how you felt, or was it a sort of continuation of your feelings on where we are and what we need to do and what the trajectory the Earth was on?
Yeah, I haven't dramatically changed my mind about any of this kind of stuff. I mean, I've become more pro-nuclear, I think, because the situation has been so urgent, and I've read up on this, and I even wrote a book on it and did some research, which really showed to me how much of a role nuclear could play if we wanted it to. I think I'm more optimistic in some ways because we've got technologies are now there which weren't there before. Solar power looked like it looked like a long shot, to be honest, back in 2007. Now it's just so cheap. I wouldn't say it's too cheap to meter because that's been used before, but it's so cheap now in hot desert countries that, I mean, they're putting in a new solar farm in Abu Dhabi, I think, which is about $1.25 a megawatt hour. I mean, it's tiny amounts of money. It's like a tenth the price of what we're all paying for our electricity.
And the solar technologies that we can use in cloudy places like Ireland has gotten much better.
Yeah. I mean, given that solar panels are cheaper than they've ever been and getting cheaper all the time, it means that even in relatively cloudy places, it's still worth putting them on large spaces and like rooftops and so on. I wouldn't want to cover the whole countryside in solar farms in rural Ireland, because you're better off putting them in hot deserts, to be honest, and generating the energy there. But that's what I'm saying. It's like, it depends where you are. Iceland's got loads of geothermal and they're pretty much carbon free already because they've got hot rocks. So you might have something else than hot rocks, like offshore wind, or, you know, still some solar potential as well, or whatever. So it really, all countries are different, and diversity is your friend, I think, when it comes to energy.
When we think about oil, and obviously oil has absolutely fallen through the floor, will we see the same countries exporting solar in the same way, or is that a capacity that is unlikely to be reached? So you're talking about Abu Dhabi, you know, these really, really hot countries. Are they likely to be the epicenter of energy production, even in a greener environment?
Yeah, and that's a really interesting question. I mean, look at the Arabian Peninsula, look at Saudi Arabia. It's basically all hot desert. You couldn't really imagine a better place to put in huge solar development. It isn't going, you know, these deserts are pretty much lifeless. They're not going, so it's not going to affect the world's biodiversity. You could potentially produce carbon neutral liquid fuels. You could produce ammonia, which can then be fed into shipping and replace diesel in many applications, and even potentially further along the line be used to fly planes. So, you know, it's, I know it's a long, it's a, a long way away from our sort of original utopian vision of everyone having their own energy and their little windmills and their little solar panels on their roofs. But ultimately, this is going to have to be a massive industrial endeavor with country-sized installations in places like the Middle East to generate the solar power that we're going to need. So it is, it's a bit capitalist and it's very large scale and very industrial, but that's ultimately the world that we're currently living in. I mean, the world's been consuming 90 odd million barrels of oil a day. To produce that kind of liquid fuels using renewables, you're going to have very, very big infrastructural projects. And yes, many of those will be in the same places that are currently producing oil. And that's probably good, because then you've got something to say to the Saudis and the other Emirates. Yes, you've got a future. You're not going to go back to just running camels or whatever it was they were saying themselves. You know, there's a future in the zero carbon transition, even for those places and those companies which are currently dependent on oil.
Yeah. It'll be interesting to see how the next 30 years pans out, that's for sure. Mark Lynas, environmental writer and author of Our Final Warning, 60 Degrees of Climate Emergency. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thanks, Jonathan.